hope, resurrection in the face of death.
If I can just vent a bit here.
The question is, what is right in the sight of God?
Church is essential to being a human.
Wellity, 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 wellity. We are back once again, irreverent, with me, the Reverend J.A. Franklin. And you know what? I think our listeners have been waiting all these long weeks for an episode which is just purely focused on T.J. Pelham, the Reverend T.J. Pelham and myself having a back and forth. We've had amazing conversations with Esther O'Reilly, with Calvin Robertson, but really what has been lacking is the pure intensity of a conversation between two of us. And so I am thrilled to welcome back to the show once again, the one, the only, the man, the legend, the priest, the vicar, the prelate, the squire, the clerk in holy orders. It is none other than T.J. Pelham. How are you today, T.J.?
Yeah, I'm all right.
That was, verbose as always.
Do you know what, Jay, I'm going to make that a thing because I don't really love wellity. I'm not sure what that is. It's not a word as far as I can tell. But other than that, I love it. I know it all.
Yeah.
But there's really no response, is there? There's no response at all.
That's probably, let all mortal flesh keep silence.
That's
the hymn that comes to my mind.
Tom, great tune, a French folk tune, I believe. Actually, it's a Kentuckian, isn't it? It's one of the. It's translated from the Liturgy of St. James, a very early Orthodox Eucharistic prayer.
Yeah, it's a nice tune in D minor.
Yeah.
I'm having a Müller corner with balls. We were just talking about this offline earlier. Thought that our listeners might want to hear that. I'm having a Müller corner with balls, but I really prefer the one with flakes. It's nice, but it's not quite what I really want. But you were telling me, Tom, that you like the balls, weren't you?
I do, Jamie. I must say, I don't like the banana flavour in the yogurt. I don't like many artificial sort of fruit flavours. I don't really like artificial strawberry. I don't really like artificial banana. I much prefer the vanilla.
Yeah.
It's a simpler yogurt, I think.
Mm. A simple taste. For a simple man. Tom.
Best yogurt in the world is in Lidl, actually. There's a Greek, you can get a Greek yogurt in there, which I discovered the reason it tastes so nice is that they add double cream back into it after it's gone through the process of being made into a yogurt. So it's so actually it's almost as bad for you as just having just lumps of cream on your pudding, but you can feel slightly virtuous because it's strictly speaking yogurt.
That's nice. I don't go into Lidl anymore because we do all our shopping online, which I don't like wearing masks. So I just don't go there anymore. It's just sad because I used to enjoy going to Lidl and to Aldi because I thought, you know, it's an interesting USP, isn't it? Not many products, but everything is very cheap. So,
I think the variety is pretty decent actually. The best thing is you're never quite sure what's going to be there. And I think that's the key, isn't it? That's key to the shopping experience. In a Tesco, you can go and you sort of memorize your route around the store after a while.
Yeah.
Everything absolutely. Is, you put your hand out and you can take
it's
it off
very,
the shelf.
It's all very predictable, isn't it?
Whereas Lidl, sometimes you walk in and, miraculously there's five steaks for 10 quid.
That would make my day.
Well, it makes
five
my day.
Is an awkward number.
Really awkward number. Nonetheless, that's a really good value, good quality steaks.
That's two for Sarah, but three for you. And that would just be unfair on Sarah.
Well, she's smaller than me by about that ratio. So, I mean, it's not actually unfair, is it, if you think about it?
No, that's
depends
that's
how good. You value things. Oh, there's a segue.
Oh, yeah. Ooh. Well, maybe that is a segue. But, and that question of value is very important. But I was going to ask you, Tom, on a serious note, I know you said, oh, yeah, I'm okay. But seriously, how are you doing today? Because I am feeling a bit fed up of the lockdown. The weather here is appalling. It couldn't really be worse, to be honest with you. And just the news seems, I mean, to be honest with you, Tom, I don't actually look at the news very much. In fact, if we didn't do this podcast, I think I might just decide not to look at the news for about another 2 months or something like that. But I feel a certain duty to look at it because I don't want to sound too ignorant. But I don't know, I'm feeling pretty fed up and the news is relentlessly awful.
Yep.
And yeah, I mean, how are you doing with it all, Tom? And what's your take on all the, you know, all the latest blatherings that have been sent our way?
I mean, we've got a couple of things going on, haven't we, Jamie? We've obviously got very high death rates for January. So we're in the middle of a proper second wave, I'd say. It's quite nasty in many hospitals across the country, I imagine. I was speaking to my local funeral directors the other day, and they are very busy. That said, we are also in the middle of a bleak lockdown, supposed to, in theory, to tame this second wave. What's happened in the last couple of days really is the government having spoken fairly hopefully about sort of being able to open up maybe at the end of February, once all the vulnerable have been vaccinated, sort of rowing back from that quicker than Oxford in the, you know, annual boat race.
Quicker than Matthew Pinsent after he's taken.
Yeah. So suddenly we get first Ferguson saying, oh, well, you know, we might have some restrictions by the autumn, he says, by autumn, we might be in a situation where we have fewer restrictions than we have now. And you know what, Jamie? I sincerely hope so.
By autumn,
yeah. And then we had Boris the rumours have been about Easter, but then it was more, oh, by Easter, we might be able to meet our families outside. That's early April, so that's a whole extra month on top of what they originally sort of we're talking about. It's a month after all the vaccinated, all the vulnerable are not just vaccinated but have the protection of the vaccine. We spoke a couple of weeks ago about this, the idea of this kind of looming sort of central ground of people, you know, Alistair Hames, Christopher Snowden, various people saying, well, actually, you know, we can support this lockdown because it's going to be time limited and, you know, lifted once the vaccinations are done. And I said at the time, well, hang on a second, that's not yet on the table, is it? And indeed, it's still not on the table. They're refusing to give a sort of reasonable timeline. Matt Hancock has said that he has four criteria. He likes his four criteria. If you remember in the summer, we had four criteria, half of which were completely
unobtainable.
And the other half of which were sort of things like, you know, the NHS couldn't cope with any second wave. It was one of the criteria for locking down in the summer. Now, it's completely, again, impossible to gauge whether restrictions in the summer would have had any effect on the wave going on now. He's now looking at, so we've got a substantial reduction in cases is one of them, substantial reduction in deaths. Hospitals' capacity is got to be free, and then the final one, which is the stinger, really, is no new variants.
Yeah.
Now, there have been hundreds of thousands of variants of COVID. It is not even a something which is possible to say no new variants. What I think he means is no new variants which are escaping the vaccine or have a higher reproduction rate, but this is an impossible thing. Viruses always mutate. If that is actually a criteria for the government, we literally won't be unlocked. It's effectively zero COVID is the only way out of that, and zero COVID is madness, impossible probably, complete madness, relies on the continued squashing of the economy and the people of this country for months and months beyond where there's any even hope of a sensible kind of cost-benefit analysis. And I'm not even certain that's been reached for this lockdown currently, but you know, certainly not going to be reached for zero COVID, especially if we assume if we sort of follow the government's reasoning, especially once the vulnerable have been vaccinated, there will be, you know, there should be, according to the initial results, and we'll see whether this is true, should be a 95% reduction in deaths and hospitalizations, which would make this disease literally safer than the flu. On a population level. That's kind of
yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, and I saw a tweet from ITV News with these criteria that were laid out from Matt Hancock, and I just thought, when I saw this, this doesn't surprise me in any way. They've implied very, very strongly that the vaccine is going to bring an end to this, and now they're thinking of other criteria which are going to continue it. And I think that, you know, I had this feeling that this horrible feeling that these decisions are being arrived at in the most arbitrary way imaginable. I just think that it's probably, you know, Hancock, Johnson, Michael Gove, the scientific advisors, Witty and Valance, and maybe Rishi Sunak. They're just all in a room, just thrashing this stuff out, making these decisions about what's going to happen to our country. And it's really scary because I don't know if there's like a technical term for this, but they've obviously got locked in to a particular way of thinking about things, and there's no way of them breaking out of it. Now the only categories they appear to think about are you know, the virus and you know, us fighting it, and those are the only things that are important to them. They can't seem to see the, as we've said many times before, the devastation that this is wreaking on our society. And not only that, Tom, it's not just even about the tangible stuff that we've talked about quite a lot before, but it's the sense of hopelessness that this is bringing to people. I mean, I've had a particularly upsetting email exchange with a nice person who wrote to me just talking of her utter despair at this situation. Just she lives by herself and, you know, crying day and night, just her life just feels like it's completely over. And this is the way it is for so many people. It just kills your soul, especially when I think these scientific advisors come out and they start, you know, just unilaterally declaring that by, you know, by autumn, some restrictions will be lifted. I mean, this is insane. You know, people cannot live like this for this length of time. And I'll tell you what my big thought is this week, actually, Tom. I was following quite closely. There's been a lot of criticism of Toby Young this week, who runs the Lockdown Skeptics website. And for those who follow Toby Young quite closely, there's been a lot of banter between him and his co-host on the London Calling podcast, James Dellingpole. But I was thinking, I read that Christopher Snowden piece and everything, and I was thinking that for me, this whole issue has clarified a lot. And I have, you know, as you know, Tom, I have been skeptical about the science, the way that science has been politicized, the way that it's been misused, the way it's been presented to us as some kind of, you know, objective set of facts which we can all access with the right amount of training, and there's a clear kind of political a set of political policies that arrive from this kind of objective view of science, all of which we know is just not right. This is not the way science works at all. And politics is politics. We, you know, make political decisions based on scientific evidence, but the scientific evidence itself does not imply some kind of political strategy. All of this stuff. But I think my perspective on this has changed, and I've been quite convinced by listening to Laura Perrins, who writes for, I think it's called, is it Conservative
Home? Conservative Woman.
Oh, Conservative Woman. Yeah. I mean, her basic point, where she starts from, is that she says that this whole strategy of locking people down in their homes is unethical. She's a lawyer, and the way she puts it is that there are certain things in law that you're just not allowed to do because of the the harm that they cause to other people. And so torture would be one of those things. Torture is always illegal in our country, regardless of what the consequences will be, right? So if you've got somebody, you know, you've got a terrorist in the corner, there's a bomb in a school, and the terrorist knows the code, you're not allowed to torture the terrorist to get the code, right? It's illegal. You're not allowed to do it. And so you can't. You have to find another way of disarming the bomb, you know? Maybe it's through some other means, you know, getting the torturer to talk in some way or disarming the bomb or whatever, but you can't torture them. And she applies that to the situation by saying that what's going on at the moment is, for some people, a form of torture. For example, the locking of old people away in their care homes and the separating of them from their spouses or their family and friends. And for many children who are in terrible domestic situations, or indeed for just people who are single and who are isolated in their homes and suffering from depression and anxiety. This is a form of torture. And so it's fundamentally unethical. And I think that, I mean, whether or not you take the torture comparison, whether you agree with that or not, I nevertheless think that she's right. I think that the basic issue here is not, you know, what is going on with the virus or how many people are dying and so on. These are important things. But the principal point here is to say that this whole idea of locking people in their homes with the threat of police force is unethical, and it should never have been pursued as a policy. I know everyone's, you know, sick of hearing about Sweden, but the difference, in my view, between what we've done and what's going on in Sweden is not that Sweden took no measures and didn't take it seriously, but that they did it by asking people to behave in certain ways, you know, asking people to social distance, mm-hmm. asking people to set up their businesses in certain ways. They didn't force them to do it, and they didn't lock them in their homes under threat of police censure. And I think that is the thing which is so damaging about this current situation, is that sense in which we have been forced to do this by the government, which is really, it's a style of political leadership which is actually a redolent of the Chinese Communist Party, not a free liberal democracy, which is what we at least used to be. It was interesting that Neil Ferguson actually said, did you see this, that he said that they didn't think they'd be able to get away with copying China to begin with, but then I think they saw it worked in Italy, the lockdown, and the Italians went with it, so they thought they could do it here as well.
I agree with you, Jamie. Quite aside from anything else, the efficiency of lockdowns, anything else, whether they should ever really be an option in a liberal democracy is a serious question that hasn't been asked. It's quite beside the point that they may or may not be effective. You know, there are many things that China does that are probably effective. The treatment of
they literally sealed people in their homes in China.
But I mean going on further than that, you know, China seems to be quite capable of using awful force against its own citizens at its own will. I'm sure it's effective, but we wouldn't ever do it because it's immoral, and that's the key point, isn't it? Yes, and then suddenly how we've ended up at a point where skeptics have been attacked ceaselessly by press, by Tory MPs, by Neil O'Brien, think tanks and various other people, and of course by the public health experts that all seem to fire quite happily from the hip across Twitter and across the press whilst advising governments, which is, I think, a slightly dubious way for advisory sort of council to work. But anyway, and what we are doing as being skeptical of lockdowns is simply being skeptical of the greatest infringement on human rights that has ever been seen in the UK.
Yeah,
and let's not beat around the bush. That's what it is. Yeah, people
a significant distance.
People might compare it to the wartime restrictions, and certainly there were restrictions then. But let's not pretend they're anywhere near the same. My wife's grandmother remembers the war well. She says that this is far worse because at least in the war you could go and meet people.
Yeah.
You could go to the pub. I mean, she wasn't going to the pub. People came into her house. They used to play darts And she'd play the piano for the soldiers down the end of the field. You know, this is it was tolerable. In other words, yeah. This is not tolerable. It's not tolerable for any length of time. It's not something. It's not a way of dealing with viruses. The dealing that should be allowed to happen again.
Yeah.
And of course, unfortunately, now the people who have got into control have seen they can push this button. They will push it again. I mean, there's some talk from Lindsay Hoyle, Speaker of the House of Commons, muttering about how some of these restrictions used against the coronavirus could be used against to prevent global warming.
You're joking? Yeah.
No. He's mused about it openly. I mean, I think.
Oh my goodness.
You know, and you think.
You just think it couldn't get any worse, really. No. And then it does.
But it's an obvious thing. Once a government takes that power, it thinks, how can you use it? I'm sure, you know, C.S. Lewis has been prescient through this whole thing. And of course he, and it's a quote that's been banded around a lot, but it seems to be never more true, writes about the tyrannies, the tyranny of people who are doing it for your good.
Yeah.
Because that sort of tyranny never sleeps, because it's always, self-righteously being pushed along, whereas a tyranny, at least an evil robber baron, he surmises, might sleep or get bored. His lazy eye might let things go. Not so for the tyranny of public health. They will not stop. And we've got a government that's in hock to them. It's
crazy. And you know what else, Tom, I've been thinking is I don't know whether I ever have, but I am going forward in the future, I'm going to resist applying the term lockdown skeptic to myself, because it's not because I care about being associated with anyone like Toby Young. It's just because I think the phrase doesn't actually capture what my position is. Now, I'm not a lockdown skeptic. I mean, I'm skeptical of whether these lockdowns are actually doing what they say they're meant to do. And I certainly don't believe that they're proportional in terms of their response. But I'm not a lockdown skeptic. I'm anti-lockdown. I'm against this policy. I think this policy is wrong. I think it's immoral and unethical, and it should never have been pursued, even if it were effective. And so I'm going to refer to myself as anti-lockdown, in the same way as I would refer to myself as anti-abortion. You know, I'm not an abortion skeptic. I'm against it. I think it's wrong. And I think that this lockdown is wrong as well.
And I mean, it's really interesting that one of the things that people were forgetting, and it's particularly prevalent in Christopher Snowden's rather bizarre article. Christopher Snowden, of course, is a conservative libertarian, he calls himself, who's written a series of articles across the comparing the UK to Sweden and saying how much better life was in Sweden, and has now come out as a in favour of this lockdown, and indeed of all the other ones. The problem really is if we're looking at it from a sort of the point of view of what skeptics should be saying is not necessarily that lockdowns are ineffective, but they're wildly disproportionate against the benefits that they're purported to bring. That is to say that most of the benefits of lockdown are achieved with much lesser regulations. If you're going to go down that route. And then the government really needs to justify why it needs to step up beyond those. So much of the benefits of lockdown are achieved by, in the case of Sweden, voluntary action.
Yeah.
In the case of Denmark, lockdown in Denmark only had, it was you were restricted to meet more than 10.
Yeah.
You know, that seems like freedom compared to what we're under here.
Oh, yeah.
They can meet up to 10 anywhere they wanted.
To meet with 10 people.
Yeah, that was lockdown in Denmark. Banning of public events in Germany was, they banned events over 1,000. All these places have different kind of rules, and there are very similar effects coming out of them, which makes you wonder exactly where the causality lies. Don't get me wrong, I think the lockdowns probably do restrict the virus. But whether they're proportionate with the harms they cause compared to lesser measures, and especially when those harms need to include not just harms to life, and there will be harms to life, harms to prosperity, and there certainly are harms to prosperity that will continue and that will impact life, but also harms to our fundamental freedoms as human beings in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just reiterate that even if it were proportional, I still wouldn't support it because I think it's unethical to do this to people. And I think there is a moral distinction between doing something which you know is going to harm people and allowing something to happen which may harm people and mitigating against the consequences. And that's the distinction I would want to draw. We could have pursued a policy whereby we protected as well as we possibly could the people who we thought were going to be vulnerable to this. And we've had an idea of that since the very beginning. You recall all those letters that were sent out to the most vulnerable. Could have protected those people, allowed everyone else to get on with their lives, accepted a risk to that group of people and indeed to people within the large group as well, but still said that it's worth it in order to keep our way of life and to not do this catastrophic damage to swathes of our population, which we knew would happen. We knew it would happen, that lockdowns would kill people. We knew it would damage the young. We knew it would damage the old, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we didn't do that. We pursued this policy. And now, as you say, Tom, it seems like we have one of the harshest lockdowns in the Western world. And there's no hope it's going to end anytime soon. I mean, we're talking about, I heard today that Dominic Raab has said, when the lockdown is lifted, we're just going to be back into the tier system. So, we're in tier three anyway, which is basically the same.
Yeah. Right?
So who cares? I mean, it doesn't make any difference if you're in tier three or locked down. It's basically the same thing.
You can meet more people outdoors, which isn't really a vector of the virus anyway. So why they're worried about it, I don't know. That's pretty much the only difference, isn't it? I think you might be able to go into pubs and eat on your own. Can you do? No, I don't think you can in tier three.
No, you can't. No, all the pubs are closed in tier three.
Tier two that you can go into pubs.
I mean, I've been in this situation now pretty much since the beginning of November, if not before. I can't even remember now. But, we had a lockdown in November. We've been in tier three, we've got another lockdown, then we're going to be in tier three. It's just the same thing. It doesn't make any difference. We're just in a permanent lockdown and it's intolerable. Maybe we should talk about this this Lord Sumption controversy. I'm sure you've been across this, Tom.
But
for people who don't know, Lord Sumption went on, I believe it was the Big Questions, and he was trying to make the point, which is, In itself, it's an uncontroversial point, isn't it? That in what's in some ways quite crudely called health economics, distinctions have to be made between individuals and their quality of life, or what's called a quality adjusted life years. So the best way of explaining this is that when in intensive care or in A&E or wherever, that when there's a situation in which two people would need a certain treatment and only one ventilator or whatever is available, you'd use this metric, which basically tries to work out in a rough sense, how many years does this person have left to live, likely speaking, and what level of quality of life would that person have with those years? So very simply, if it were me and a five-year-old child, the five-year-old child would get it because he'd have a lot longer to live. If it was me and a 95-year-old, I'd get it because I have a lot longer to live. And all things being equal.
And I think in fairness, if the process would give the 95-year-old more years than it would be able to give you, then you would then the 95-year-old would get it, and you wouldn't.
If I were terminally ill or something with something which is going to kill me in 6 months' time or something, I think Sumption was trying to make this point, and then a lady came on who had I think stage 4 bowel cancer, and she said, "I'm one of those people whose life you're saying has no value," and he interrupted her, and I think he was unwise to say this, but nevertheless, I still think he's been misunderstood here. He interrupted her and said, I didn't say it was of no value. I said it was of less value. Right now, that's technically completely in keeping with the point that he was making about these so-called qualies. But it did sound a little bit, cruel to say that to this lady. So I think it was probably a misstep on his part. However, what I would say is that the reaction on Twitter and the press has, has willfully misunderstood the point that he was making and interpreted it in the most uncharitable way that they possibly could have done. And this is epitomized in a conversation he had with Piers Morgan on Good Morning Britain, in which Piers Morgan is basically saying to him that he was making some kind of moral distinction between say this lady's life and his or somebody else's, as though he were going around sort of playing God and saying, you know, well, this person has a right to live, this person doesn't, you know, making some kind of moral judgment on people, which of course is exactly the opposite point that he was trying to make, which was about having an objective criteria, an objective standard, which you use to decide who gets certain types of healthcare. My feeling is that it really shows, Tom, I think, the degraded level of public conversation in our culture, where you can't have any kind of reasonable conversation without people looking to take offense, to take things out of context, and to try and have one of those, you know, one of those gotcha moments where, oh, you know, Lord Sumption has disgraced himself, he should be cancelled, he should be ostracized from the public square, look what he said, etc., etc. It's just a really, really sad state of affairs that the public conversation is this debased and this degraded in our culture. I don't know what your view is, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I mean, we've spoken a bit about this before, because I'm absolutely certain that he is not saying that that humans do not have equal dignity and value on a sort of philosophical level, because we all do. There's no difference in value between a 5-year-old and a 95-year-old. They're both to be loved by God. They're both, in a sense, infinitely valued. But that's not the question they were talking around. They're talking about how do we allocate resources within a resource-starved area. And it's always going to be a resource-starved area. We cannot put all of our money towards public health or health. And even if we did, that wouldn't necessarily be the best outcome. So you've got a resource-limited area which needs to work out objectively how to best and most beneficially spend those resources, and that's the question that he was answering. Nothing to do with sort of inherent values. He's not a eugenicist. He's not a there's no sense in which he's advocating, as some people I've seen that have claimed that, you know, that the sort of slippery slope argument that, you know, under this criteria, wouldn't a rich person have more value than a poor person, or wouldn't an intelligent person be saved in front of a less intelligent person? No, he's not saying that. I don't think he would ever say that.
It's just absurd to even say such a thing.
It's not that argument is not the same. But one can only have the suspicion that he's being attacked in this way simply because he is a leading lockdown opponent, a critic on the basis of human rights and good governance.
Well, I mean, what I was going to say, Tom, is that I think that this accusation of playing God, I think this is more apt for the proponents of lockdown than it is for somebody like Lord Sumption, because what they are doing is they're essentially saying that people who have COVID or people who might have COVID should be treated ahead of people who have other illnesses, right? So people who have got terminal cancer are not receiving the same level of care, right? So they're being, in a sense, sacrificed for COVID patients. Well, who said that was morally acceptable? You know, it's the proponents of lockdown. And in a similar way, our children are being sacrificed. You know, kids who are at school, their education is being sacrificed. Young adults, their future is being sacrificed because they won't be able to get jobs. People who are at university, their university education is being sacrificed. Old people who would prefer to see their friends and carry on with their normal lives, people in care homes who can't see their family or their spouses anymore, they're being sacrificed. So these moral judgments are being made, but they're being made by people who are the proponents of lockdowns. People who are against lockdowns are saying that that everyone should be considered in this, which has always been my position. Everybody should be considered, not just people who are vulnerable to COVID. And that what's happened is that our whole society has become myopically obsessed with one issue, and it's to the detriment of everybody who's not affected by that issue, and it's fundamentally unjust. And it, as I say, it's completely the opposite of what Jonathan Sumption was trying to say. And indeed, I think he is trying to make the point that I've just made. I just think it was unfortunate that he made that one slightly callous misstep in sort of interrupting this woman to say what he did. But as you say, Tom, it's the press apparatus, isn't it, which has been so extremely in favour of lockdowns, that it's just taking any opportunity it can get to try and smear somebody like him, who otherwise is so eminent, you know, in terms of his career, in terms of his prodigious intellect and so on, that they just try and, you know, they're just trying to sort of take him down.
Yeah, they are.
So did you see the Piers Morgan interview?
I don't watch anything with him in it.
I listened to it earlier, and honestly, it was so obviously willfully misunderstanding over and over again. And you know, the bad thing about it as well is part of the way through this, because there were several other people in this interview, Lord Sumption actually said, look, you asked me to come on this show to talk about this opinion poll, which they'd quoted, this opinion poll, which was in favour of more lockdowns. He said, you know, if you're not going to ask me about that opinion poll, and you're going to keep on saying the same thing over and over again, I'm just going to go off the line. So that indicates further just how scurrilous this media assault on Lord Sumption is, to invite him on a show ostensibly about one thing and then to grill him about something else. And then there was another lady who was an academic, and she was saying that the reason that we're in this situation now is because of people like Lord Sumption. So they said to her, you know, is there evidence that lockdowns work? And she said, yeah. Because lockdowns reduce the amount of contact, therefore they work. And the reason that we're in this situation is because people like Lord Sumption are promoting an anti-lockdown line, which means that the government can't go full whack into lockdown as they did in China. This is what they were saying. Look at China. China locked down. Now they're all free and economically prosperous. We should have done what China did. And of course, Lord Sumption said quite rightly that we don't want to copy China, because they're a thoroughly illiberal, immoral. Well, they have a thoroughly illiberal, immoral government that is genocidal and that has absolutely no respect for the rights and dignity of their citizens. Anyway, it was. Yeah, I mean, I don't watch anything to do with Piers Morgan either, but I thought I'd just catch up on that. But it just gives you a little insight into what's actually going on for many people in our country who are watching these things day after day, having them pumped into their brains. So disappointing, I think, Tom. And of course, you know, theologically, we'd want to say, you know, of course, we're all equal in God's sight, aren't we? You know, God loves us all, and he loves us all equally, whether we're young or old. And of course, as believers, we also hold that the human beings will live forever. So we are eternally valuable in that sense. But that's not what Sumption was talking about. So, yeah, I don't know. Have you anything else to add on that, Tom, or should we?
I think that's pretty thorough. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we've smashed that one. The next thing I wanted to talk about, Tom, is a really good article in The Spectator by Father Jonathan Bezick. And now this was an article, wasn't it? Father Jonathan is a blast from the past from us, because we both knew him when we lived in Oxford. And Bezick, Father Bezick, was the rector, I think he was the rector, of St. Barnabas in Jericho. So a big shout out to Father Jonathan, if he's listening. It was great to see this article. Tom, do you want to give a little précis of the article?
Well, yeah, okay. Just going to grab it out again. But effectively, he's calling for churches to remain open, the pointing out the absurdities of churches closing in the first lockdown. I mean, he rather touchingly, and those of you who know him may have smiled gently when he wrote about going and posting a letter through the letterbox of the Archbishop of Canterbury in Lambeth, because he is notoriously doesn't use email, which is, I think, great. Just generally speaking about how the church is serving God's work in this time, and how it should never have been shut down and shouldn't feel the pressure to shut down at this time.
Yeah.
It's a really great article. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, sorry. I was going to come in. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a really good article, and I'd like to just read a little quote here from it with a really nice phrase here at the beginning. He talks about the incarnational deficit in the church. The incarnational deficit in the church is bloodless and disembodied. If it takes flesh at all, it does so in the likeness of a dull managerialism, an aversion to risk, an obsession with statistics and restructuring, and with the pernicious encroachments of critical race theory and unconscious bias training. During the first lockdown, the poor parochial clergy were reminded endlessly that our first duty was to stay at home, protect the NHS and save lives, and that even though our churches were now closed for worship, it was wonderful and right that they should be open for food banks and blood donor sessions. I rubbed my eyes in disbelief. Baked beans and nappies, good. Body of Christ, bad. Pints of human blood, good. The body of Christ, bad. Surely we could have both. And then he carries on there. But I mean, I think that just encapsulates quite a bit, doesn't it? And it does actually tie into this other issue, which we've been seeing this week, which is that many churches, and I think primarily cathedrals, have been, they've closed down for worship, but they've opened as vaccination centres. Have you been across this, Tom?
Yeah, I have. I believe my own cathedral, Salisbury Cathedral, is very happy to be a vaccination centre. And yet, you know, do you know what, Jamie? There are probably hundreds of places that could be vaccination centres. There are very few places that could be cathedrals. You've got to wonder why they consider it to be safe enough to have people queuing in there to receive a shot in the arm, and yet not safe enough for people to be sitting there and praying and praising God together. It's bonkers.
Yeah, and I mean, our friend Daniel French has put a tweet up here in response to the Salisbury Cathedral. You know, they tweeted out very very grandly that their medieval interior has been transformed into a vaccination center. And Daniel wrote, how will this doesn't really make grammatical sense, but he talks about the theological dissonance of having the cathedral closed for Holy Communion but busy for vaccination. I've even seen people on Twitter taking the proverbial, e.g., medieval times those thickos came to touch relics expecting miracles, but now here is a real one. So he's asking the same questions as Father Jonathan, which is why is it the case that the church can be open for vaccination but it can't be open for Holy Communion? And again, this kind of, you know, it comes back to this question of, you know, what is the church actually for? You know, in Father Jonathan's article, he talks about that he bumped into a parishioner during the first lockdown and said, you know, sadly, the church is closed. And the parishioner said, well, you know, either it matters or it don't. And
well, that's exactly it, isn't it? We've said that before. Either this is a life-saving, activity that God calls us to do, to meet together, to pray, to praise, to receive the body and blood of Christ in the Eucharist, or none of it really matters, and we're just killing ourselves. our actions speak louder than our words. You can't at the same time claim that we are saved from death by Christ, and yet at the same time stop preaching Christ in our churches for fear of illness and death.
Father Jonathan also appeared on a Spectator podcast with, I think it was the Dean of Blackburn Cathedral.
Yeah.
And honestly, this exchange, it just kind of epitomizes the whole problem here. And also on Father Daniel's tweet as well, you could just see the same thing over and over again. Like, you know, it's loving to vaccinate people. It shows love. It's risky to open for worship. You can pray anywhere, you know, you can worship together virtually. You can't get vaccinated virtually. Another thing the Dean of Blackburn said, he didn't quite say it like this, but he basically said that you can't trust people. If you leave the church open, they'll go other places, you know, they'll stop at coffee shops, they'll stop to talk to people and so on. And we're just it's all about reducing risk, and it's about reducing those contacts. And, you know, Tom, I don't accept any of this, obviously, but even if you're not, you know, like we spoke about this on our episode about the Eucharist, didn't we? But even if you're not a Catholic with a small C, and you know, you don't, you know, you've got a very low view of the Eucharist, say, where, you know, you just think it's a kind of ordinance and a memorial. Even if that were the case, surely one would also accept that this weakens the church. I mean, surely you'd accept that it weakens the church, not that we're not allowed to meet together physically. You know, we can't, you know, for evangelicals, for example, we can't run alpha courses. You know, we just can't do it. You could do it online, but it's very, very different. You know, people can't make those genuine connections. So you can't do that. You can't invite people to come to a church service. I mean, at the very least, it weakens the church. So this kind of thing of saying, well, you know, basically we can just, you know, translate church online and have our churches open as vaccination centres. It just doesn't, you know, it doesn't work for me, Tom. You know, and I know we're kind of repeating ourselves here, but there's a kind of incipient, or is it incipient, or is it just a kind of opportunistic, extreme low church Protestantism? I don't know what you think. Tom, but the, you know, the Dean of Blackburn pulled this out. He said, oh, you know, Christ said, you know, not on this mountain or that mountain, you know, therefore we can close the church. I mean, this is an extreme Protestantism, isn't it?
It's really weird. I mean, once again, it's a strange misunderstanding of what church is. I mean, we have spoken about this, I know, at length, but it's worth revisiting every now and again, because the church is not a building. The building is a convenient place for the rituals of the church to take place. The church is the gathering, the ecclesia of God's people. And so, whilst Christ might have said, not on this mountain or on that mountain, you know, wherever, and indeed, wherever two or three people meet in my name, there I am. You know, it doesn't have to be in a particular place, but you know, do you know what? It's convenient to be indoors and in a particular place. And it is important that we meet. So to sort of turf out the gathering of God's faithful people, in replace of a vaccination center is it just makes no sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the other thing that the Dean of Blackburn said, and I'm just trying to think, because Daniel sent me a very good response to this, but one of the other things he said is that we're basically following the model of the early church, which is something I've heard. I know the Archbishop of Canterbury said it as well many months ago, but I'm sorry to say, that is total nonsense. We're not following the model of the early church by meeting in people's homes at all, because we're not meeting in people's homes, right? No. The early church weren't meeting on Zoom. They were physically gathering in people's homes. And yeah, here it is from Daniel. He said that a priest called, you might know him, the priest Peter Anthony made a video about this. And he pointed out that the Eucharist was not so much celebrated in people's homes in the early church, like some, you know, quasi-evangelical house group, a kind of proto-evangelical house group, but that shockingly, some people actually gave up their homes totally, and that this was the beginning, as it were, of church buildings. They were actually people's houses who were given up, which were given up, you know, perhaps wealthy people, but perhaps also people who were not wealthy, to make that kind of radical sacrifice so that the church had a place to meet. So this idea that, you know, staying in your house forever and not seeing any other Christians and just doing everything on Zoom, the comparison with the early church is just extraordinary, isn't it, Tom? I mean, it's nothing like the early church in any way. So, you know, it's, I mean, I guess the only way it's even remotely comparable is, you know, in the idea that, you know, in the early church, they hadn't yet developed, you know, any idea of kind of consecrated space or anything like that. But, you know, it's not similar in the sense that the early church were actually physically gathering, and they are saying that physically gathering is not important. The early church was persecuted for gathering physically. Christians all around the world are persecuted for gathering physically. They're not persecuted for online Zoom church. They're persecuted for gathering physically, and they take the risk, which is not just a risk to them personally, it's a risk to people they meet with, everybody who's associated with them, their friends, their families, because they consider the gathering, the ecclesia of Christians, to be of the utmost importance. Yeah.
And I think that's really key, that there is actually, people say, oh, well, they're only risking their own lives. No, they're not. They're risking, by meeting, the lives of everyone who's there and the lives of their families and friends often, their contacts. There's no doubt about it. It is analogous to COVID in many ways, you know, probably far more dangerous, in fact.
Absolutely. Yeah, so it's just, I don't know about you, Tom, but it's just the same kind of relentless thing over and over again. I mean, where we're going to end up with all this stuff, I don't know. I know that in our diocese, we have 90% of the churches here are closed voluntarily. I've heard the figure of 75% closed in Chichester, which is probably the most Catholic diocese.
Of my curate group, ours is the only church that's open.
Really?
Yeah. We're quite lucky in that both I and my TI are quite robust on this. We didn't really see it as there being any other option but to remain open.
Yeah.
And we're lucky in that we've got a big church with two entrances, and, you know, actually, to be honest, Jimmy, the congregation is rather small at the moment, but that doesn't really matter. As we said, there's a, the movement from if you don't want to, you don't have to go to church, which is, you know, if someone feels unsafe, you know, you need to, you know, square that with God. It's not my business to worry about that. Yeah. We'll provide a safe an environment as we can. To you should not, which is effectively what people are saying, is or indeed even must not, is a big movement. And whilst there are still two or three gathering, the church is witnessing to the continued light of Christ in the world at this time.
Yeah.
This time of Epiphany.
Yeah.
It's all about that witness to the light of the changing light of Christ in our lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know something else, Tom, I would say about this is it's up to parishioners whether or not they want to come to church. You know, it's not, I find this idea that priests should be telling people not to come to church extraordinary. You know, it's a bizarre situation when you've got a priest, somebody who actually, you know, ostensibly believes in the ministry of the church, telling parishioners that it's too risky for them to come. Oh, you know, because you're older, or because you're unhealthy or whatever. It's their choice. You know, it's their choice whether or not they want to come to church. You know, I just think that's, you know, the idea that that parishioners should be protected by clergy. I just think that is paternalism, and it's, you know, it's infantilization of parishioners. And also, you know, the other thing I think, Tom, is that for all the Church of England's talk of the priesthood of all believers, it's profoundly hierarchical, isn't it? When you've got a priest telling everyone what to do. I mean, how much more hierarchical could you possibly get? Oh, you know, you're a bit, you know, you don't really understand how dangerous this is, so I'm going to tell you, you mustn't come to church. It's not very sort of, it's not very in keeping with the spirit of the priesthood of all believers. Do you see what I mean?
It's very patronizing.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? I would never even think of people in those terms. And a year ago, we'd never had done, had we? But somehow we've slipped into this. But there we go, Tom. I mean, I think we've covered all the bases. I mean, part of the problem at the moment is that just, you know, nothing is really happening, is it? It's just we feel like we're just in the middle of a kind of relentless, dark, cold winter. And the question is, you know, will the world ever emerge?
Well, Jamie, I have hope that it will. Do you know what? My main hope comes from the good sense of some of our older citizens. Once they're vaccinated, the idea the government will prevent them from doing whatever they want is, I think, rather harebrained. You know, they don't have long enough on this earth to worry about, you know, anything else. Once, I think, so my hope is that, if that sounds harsh, then I don't think it is, actually. I think, you know, everyone gets cognizant of their own mortality, especially if you're 85, you've had your vaccine. Are you really going to do what the government say and remain indoors, not seeing your friends now that you are pretty much safe from COVID? I would be surprised if everyone did. You know, I'm hoping that the government will see compliance breakdown long before it decides to open up. In that sense, you know, and there's something rational about that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Obviously, what you're saying is rational, but it's a question of whether it will actually happen or not, because we can already see that they're starting to warn about the possibility of further variants of the coronavirus. And this is my worry, is that this is just gonna, you know, another variant will be discovered and we'll be told that we need another vaccine and this will just go on permanently.
Yeah, I know. And but you know, I mean in the end, Jamie, in the end this government would collapse.
Well, yeah, eventually, but it's gonna take a long time, isn't it?
And in the end, there's no money going in. And I'm sorry, but the world, you know, it's not about lives versus money. It's lives versus lives. If we impoverish ourselves completely, and we already have, the more we continue, the closer to the end point we come, which is a country which can't afford its own NHS, can't afford, you know, we will see quite possibly the sort of hyperinflation that we saw in the 1940s, it won't be pretty.
Yeah. Do you think, Tom, let me ask you this, right? So the economic devastation of this is going to be felt palpably on a much wider scale in the years to come.
Yeah, yeah.
Say in 2 or 3 years, we're living in a significantly poorer country where unemployment is like, you know, nothing we've ever seen before. Maybe people have lost their pensions, maybe the banks have collapsed, you know, goodness knows what could have happened. But say we're in a situation like that, which I think is, you know, it's very likely something like that is going to happen. Do you think public opinion will turn against this policy and people will look back on it and say, either I regret supporting it, or even in their own minds, they'll say, oh yeah, I was never really that in favor of it in the first place? Or do you think people will just insist that, you know, we had to do this and actually it's completely sensible and we would do it again if we need to? What do you think people are going to think, you know, say in 2, 3, maybe 5 years time?
Do you know what, Jamie, I really hope that it's not the case, but I fear that actually this is a battle that's been lost.
Yeah. Well, so you think people will just say, oh, we had to do it, you know, this...
Well, if we hadn't done it, then we'd have, you know, it'd be even worse. Yeah. It's quite possible. I don't know, Jamie. Part of me hopes that won't be the case, but you know.
Well, my feeling is, Tom, that people support this policy largely because of fear, right? They've been made to be afraid by the government, either for themselves or for other people. If that fear subsides, which at some point you think it probably will, and people, the dominant emotion becomes one of a sense of loss because of, you know, poverty and life becomes so much more difficult and so on, I think it could be the case that people emotionally turn against this policy and say to themselves that this is causing such misery that we should never have done it and we shouldn't do it again. I think it's possible that people might start thinking about that. I think at the moment people are responding in a very sort of visceral way to all the what I consider to be propaganda that's been pumped into our homes for almost a year now. They're responding in a very sort of emotional and I think largely rational way to what's going on. I think it could be in a few years when they see the damage, when they feel the devastation themselves, either for themselves personally or for the world around, I think they might start to reassess. But I think this could take many years. In fact, it could be, you know, like Pete Hitchens says about the Iraq War, he was one of the few who was against it at the time. Now everybody seems to think that they were against it when it happened, you know, but it wasn't very many people. It might be something like that. But the Iraq War was almost 20 years ago, you know, and so it takes time for public opinion to change. So we may have lost, as you say, but we may also be in it for the long haul.
We just got to hope that at least governments see that this can't be done ad infinitum. And it's kind of one of those things, I've said it before, if something just isn't repeatable, then it shouldn't, you know, it shouldn't be used.
Yeah. Or it should be used when there is some kind of existential threat, which is so certain that there's no ambiguity about it. Now, I don't agree with the lockdown, and I think it's immoral. But if you take the analogy with the Second World War, for example, right? If we hadn't had the Second World War, the Nazis would have invaded us. They would have taken over Western Europe. They would have, apart from anything else, they would have killed all the Jews, disabled people, and all the other groups of people they were exterminating, they would have done at least those things and many other awful, terrible things. And, you know, the whole of Western civilization would have been transfigured into this awful regime. I'm sure you've seen The Man in the High Castle, you know, that terrible vision of the future under Nazi and the Nazi rule. Now, we had to do that because we knew with such certainty something of what the consequences would be. But in the absence of a threat, which is that existential and that certain, we should just never do things which are so destructive of our society. And as you say, Tom, if we do this again, which I think is very likely, we're going to have nothing left. You know, we're going to have no businesses, we're going to have no jobs, we're going to have no money. Eventually, we'll have, you know, less food. You know, it's we're going to be living in some kind of wasteland if we continue to do this to ourselves.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So anyway, on that cheery note, to our listeners, if you've not heard us talk about this before, we do have a friend of the show who's put together a list of an online database of open churches. So if you're looking for an online church, or if you've got an online church and you'd like to add it to the list, do go on to the website, which is uklockdownchurches.wordpress.com. uklockdownchurches.wordpress.com, and to find a church where you can go, and hopefully you can be edified and encouraged even during these dark times. I mean, they are dark times, but at least the churches are allowed to stay open, which is quite something. You know, we have to remind ourselves that this is a good thing, and we should still be going to church and not neglecting to meet together as far as we're able. Also, email the show, irreverendpod@gmail.com. It's always good to hear from people, or follow us on Twitter @irreverendpods. So that's it. So Tom, what are you doing this evening? Anything exciting?
I doubt it, Jamie. I'm looking after Freddie, I should think.
Yeah, very good. As is your duty now for the rest of your life.
Yep.
Very good. Yeah, it's my son Rupert's third birthday tomorrow. So I'm going to make him a chocolate cake this evening, which I'm quite excited about.
Yeah. Indeed. All right. Well, God bless all our listeners, and we look forward to speaking to you again.
Yes, thank you so much. Bye now.
Bye.
Hello, listeners. Just one more thing. We've just noticed a piece of feedback from a friend of the show, Andy, for our episode on the Eucharist, where Tom and I had this great debate on the question of the real presence in the Eucharist. And I'd just like to read it out. Andy says, I've just been listening to the Eucharist episode. I did make it to the end. And he says it was like a much better controlled version of the same debate he had with a friend. It ended about 2:30 in the morning when our wives came downstairs and threatened to kill us if we woke up the children. By that point, we'd spent about 5 minutes solid with me shouting, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man, you have no life in you. And him responding with, do this in remembrance of me. Not the most productive debate, but Lagavulin does have that effect on constructive theology. And I think, Tom, you were telling me that Lagavulin is some kind of whiskey, right?
I assume it's a whiskey anyway. Do you know what? I love, you know, it's great. I mean, impassioned, personal, you know, it's the sort of thing I'm looking forward to. Jamie and I, you know, sitting down, you know, in a pub, or maybe even downstairs in my study in next year or something, with the kids upstairs in bed, and we can have a good old argument. In yep. person. Oh, it'd be wonderful. That's what I live for.
Yeah, well,
my wife hates it though. But.
Yeah, well, we might be in a very similar position to Andy and his friend at 2:30 in the morning, screaming our heads off. Yeah. So anyway, thanks for that feedback, Andy. Yeah. Do for anyone else, do send in any feedback about that or anything else. Thanks very much.